Well, good evening and welcome to the members' room of the New York Society Library. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian, and I first of all have to thank you for all coming out on a wet night. These days are challenges for us when Sarah and I both get up in the morning in our respective homes. We think the rain must stop so that everyone will show up. But we have a good crowd, and I really appreciate you coming out. This is our second month of events for this fall season, and if you are a guest with us tonight, please do pick up one of the events calendars. We have a few downstairs on the front desk, so feel free to take one. It just came out in the last couple of days, and we have more programming through December. Before I introduce our speaker, Joshua Kendall, may I ask you to take a moment, and if you have a cell phone or a pager, just take it out and silence it so it won't ring. During our event this evening, and we do record these events too, so it's wonderful when they can appear on the internet without telephones going off. This is the time of the year that we do ask our members to support our annual fund, and your contributions as members are really critical to supporting the library. They help us plan events like this evening's biography talk, build our collection of over 300,000 books, run a children's library, provide reader services, and everything we do here at the library. So thank you very much for your support. We do have copies of Mr. Kendall's book for sale tonight. Our friends from the Corner Bookstore up in Madison are here tonight, and they'll be happy to sell you a copy after the event, and Mr. Kendall will also be willing to sign your book. When you think of the Society Library, founded in 1754, you would be correct to say, well, they've probably been collecting dictionaries for a long time. We've had them from the very beginning, and we actually still have a number of very interesting dictionaries from the 1700s and 1800s. I'm happy to let you know that we actually still own a copy of the two-volume Noah Webster American Dictionary of the American Language from the year 1828. I was able to wrestle it out of the hands of the rare book staff this evening, and we have it on display here. And after our event, do feel free to come up and look at it. I'll be happy to explain it to you. We also have another really interesting item, which is an item published in 1789 in Boston, and it's Webster's Dissertations on the English Language. And it actually was a gift to the Society Library from the author, and his penmanship is inside, so you can have a look at that. We have lots of great treasures in our special collections like this. Our speaker tonight has been on a book tour across the country, I believe that's correct, and he's had the pleasure of visiting many libraries like the Society Library. We have an association of membership libraries across the country, and Mr. Kendall has been at the Athenaeum of Philadelphia on this tour. He's been to St. Louis to visit the Mercantile Library. He's been in Salem at the Athenaeum, and he's been in Newport at the Redwood. And he is also a member of the Boston Athenaeum, our colleagues up in Boston, and he spoke there as well. So we are really happy to have him rounding out his tour of the society and membership libraries across the country. Our author was born in New York City. He calls Boston his home now. He received his bachelor's degree from Yale, where he studied comparative lit. He also did graduate work in comparative lit at Johns Hopkins, and for his excellence in reporting on psychiatry, he has received national journalism awards from both the National Mental Health Association and the American Psychoanalytic Association. He is currently an associate's fellow of Yale's Trumbull College, and Mr. Kendall is also the author of a biography of another fascinating lexicographer, the author of Roget's Thesaurus. So please welcome Joshua Kendall.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here. We all have used Webster's Dictionary, but few of us know much about its creator. And now I've been going to these membership libraries across the country, also in Charleston. And in each of, in just about every stop, there's a common assumption, which is that Daniel wrote the dictionary and not Noah. At the Boston Athenaeum, my home base, as soon as you walk in there, there's a big portrait of Daniel, and people say, that's the dictionary guy. And Daniel was a Secretary of State and an eminent and a senator, but he was not a dictionary guy. And the point of my book is to say two things, that that it's Noah, not Daniel. And Noah wasn't just a word nerd, but he was actually a founding father. He was someone who gave us our cultural identity in ways that go beyond language. Now, when Noah Webster dies in 1843, he's very well known. One historian at the time says that he belongs in America's Trinity of Fame, along with Washington and Columbus. And that's not because of the dictionary, but it's because of another book that he wrote in 1783 that's not well known today, but it was the Harry Potter of its day. It's a spelling book that came out in 1783, and over the next century, it sold 100 million copies. So it taught five generations of Americans how to read. So it's basically a book that for school-age kids, teaching them language. And one of those school-age kids in 1858 was a senator from Mississippi by the name of Jefferson Davis. And here's what he says. "We have a unity of language which no other people possess, and we owe this unity above all to Noah Webster's Yankee spelling book." So with his spelling book and with his dictionary, Noah Webster is going to give us American English. I'm going to talk more about that. Now, I have a little note there about Confederate spellers, because those of you who know your history know that 3 years later, Jefferson Davis became the president of the Confederacy. At the Boston Athenaeum, and by the way, the Boston Athenaeum is actually a sister institution, and my Boston Athenaeum card allows me to take out books from here, and those of you who are members can also come to Boston. And I just want to let you know. Anyhow, one of the wonderful things that the Athenaeum has is that it has the world's largest collection of Confederate books and imprints. And during the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis, his day job was to kill us here in New England in the North, but he still loved Webster's speller. So during the Confederacy, they printed copies of the speller, which were, quote, changed for the present condition. So the speller has sample sentences, and one of the sentences was, "The president's term is 4 years." Well, Davis's term was 6 years. So in his version that comes out in Macon, Georgia, it's changed for the present condition. So, and that really underlines the fact that Webster's achievement is that today, from Maine to California, we speak the same language, American English. If you go to old Europe, you go to France or Spain or Germany, every 20 kilometers, they speak a different dialect. We don't have dialects, and that's thanks to Noah Webster. But the fascinating thing is that we could be killing each other at the same time as that we use the same language. And that's also true today, that we're a very divisive country, but we really, even though there are a few regional terms, that we can really understand each other much more easily. And that's remarkable because we're so large. Now, Noah Webster, I talk his incredible shrinking reputation. He dies in 1843. Daniel Webster is very prominent in the 1840s, so Daniel becomes the more important Webster. And then the speller goes out of print by around 1900. Those are the last of the 100 million copies are sold. And Noah Webster also has another problem, that he's very crotchety. One historian has said he wanted to write a biography of Webster, but he hated him too much. And another reason his reputation declines is this crotchety problem. And here's the way Ambrose Bierce put it in the 1911 Devil's Dictionary. Now, Bierce is a satirist who's going to take potshots at everyone, but he can't help but take one of Webster. And he says, "Hell," he defines hell as the eternal resting place of the late Dr. Noah Webster, dictionary maker. So the point of my book is to bring him out of hell and to say, okay, he was crotchety, but still he united us with his words and even did other things, which I'll get to. All right, the key dates. Noah Webster, early in his life, had what I call Forrest Gump moments associated with the American Revolution. He was a bit player. So he's born in West Hartford, and West Hartford is the only place that knows it's Noah, not Daniel. And I've spoken there, and his house is there, and if those of you who are Webster aficionados might want to visit his house. He goes to Yale, and in his summer vacation from Yale before his senior year, he fights in the Battle of Saratoga. That's one of these Forrest Gump moments. He and his father and two brothers are bit players in the Battle of Saratoga. Those of you who know your American Revolution know that that's basically the only battle that we won, and that battle was pivotal in getting the French on our side. So Webster was always proud to have been there at kind of the creation of the American nation. Another Forrest Gump moment is in 1775. George Washington comes to New Haven, and Webster greets him. Washington is en route to Cambridge, where he's going to take over command of the Continental Army. And Washington is soon to become an important figure in Webster's life. They're going to have a real relationship, but in the 1770s, Webster is just a bit player. He's the head of the Yale militia and plays his flute when Washington comes to town. All right, I told you about the speller. The official title is a Grammatical Institute of the English Language, going back to John Calvin. And really, it's a three-parter. The speller itself is the big seller, but it also has a grammar and a reader. Now, in 1785, now Webster, part of this crotchety is that he's very arrogant, and he always thinks he knows everything, and sometimes he's absolutely right. And in 1785, he has a national platform because the speller is selling, and he says he knows what's wrong with America. And when he has an idea, he goes for it, and he writes a pamphlet called Sketches of American Policy. And he's very upset because America is then very divided. So what he's trying to do linguistically is unite us with a language, but he realizes that America is also very politically divided. And he writes this pamphlet and hands it to George Washington and goes to Mount Vernon and this Yale whippersnapper is about 26 years old, goes to tell George Washington, who's then the first farmer. Washington's in between the Revolution and his presidency, and he goes to tell the first farmer what to do to fix America. And that's how my book starts, with Webster on his horse going to tell Washington how to solve America's problems. And I'll come back to that. Then in 1787, I'm calling him a forgotten founding father because in 1787, Webster is at the Constitutional Convention. He's a journalist, and in right after the convention, he writes a very influential pamphlet that's immediately circulated. He writes it in 2 days, and it's ready, and some historians have argued that his pamphlet was more influential than the Federalist Papers. The Federalist Papers are more sophisticated, but they come out later, and they're more important here in New York. But Webster's pamphlet was kind of quick and dirty. It was ready right away, and it circulated for several months longer. And I'll come back to that a little bit later as well. Now, Webster also has this New York association. In 1793, so Webster and Washington build a relationship with the sketches. In 1787, when Washington comes to the Constitutional Convention, the first thing he does is knock on Webster's hotel room door. Webster has a headache, but when George Washington knocks on your door, you answer. In 1793, Washington is president, and he has a problem that the Jeffersonians are interested in another war with England. Washington wants to stay neutral, and he turns to his right-hand man, Noah Webster Jr. And Noah Webster Jr. becomes the editor of New York City's first daily newspaper. So he commutes by horse. He lives about a mile from Wall Street. He's a Federalist editor. That's called the American Minerva. It's a daily paper. Alexander Hamilton works on that paper. Hamilton And the New York Post, which is the oldest continuously published daily newspaper, starts in 1801 because Webster and Hamilton have a fight in 1800. That's the fight that splits the Federalist Party and allows Jefferson to be elected. And then Hamilton and Webster wants to go his own way and starts the Post. Webster's paper survives until about 1930 under various different incarnations. Now, Webster makes a lot of money. He's a very good businessman. I'll be coming back to that. His speller is selling. His newspaper is doing very well. So in 1798, he retires. And he's an obsessive, and I'll talk about that in a minute. He loves compiling and organizing words more than anything else in the world. Now, this is in direct different from Samuel Johnson. Samuel Johnson wrote the first great dictionary, the English Dictionary, in 1755. Johnson said, "No one but a blockhead ever wrote except for money." Webster is the exact opposite. He made his money, but he wants to write the dictionary. He can't wait to get started. He moves back to New Haven, where he went for Yale, and he moves into the Arnold House. And yes, that's Benedict Arnold. And Webster gets a good deal because there's a lot of shame associated with the house, and the state took it over, so he gets it for around $2,300. But it's the fanciest house in town. Arnold was nouveau riche, and it's right by the water, and he wanted to show everyone in New Haven how much money he had. And Webster sets up shop in Arnold's house and decides to write the dictionary. That's in 1798, and the dictionary that you have there comes out in 1828. He's going to spend 30 years on it. But he's got to do two things. He's got to take on Samuel Johnson, but he's also got to take on Samuel Johnson Jr. And that's a funny story, because there was an American, Samuel Johnson is a Brit, of course, but there was an American dictionary that had come out just that year, 1798, written by Samuel Johnson Jr. Now, if you had an agent and you were thinking of a name for a dictionary maker, that would be a good one. Call him Johnson Jr. It was no relation. It was a Connecticut school teacher, and he had written a 5,000-word, a small dictionary. So what Webster does is he first writes a compendious, and a compendious means brief. So what he first does is he tries to replace Johnson Jr. with a compendious dictionary in 1806, and I have a page from that in my slides at the end. And these small dictionaries look like a modern-day thesaurus. They have one-word definitions. And then he's going to spend the next 20 years writing the big dictionary. All right. Noah Webster is the father of the modern publishing business. I wrote a piece for the Daily Beast about this. So he has the speller, and it's the first book published in the new United States of America. We don't have a constitution, and the states have all the power. So what Webster does is he's afraid of piracy, so he personally goes around to every single state and gets copyright law passed. And as he does that, he has the first modern book tour, and he goes from Massachusetts to South Carolina, and I've tried to go to many of those same stops. I was also in another library I went to, was in Charleston, in the first modern book tour. And he's a mocker and a business maker, and he gets blurbs. He gets a blurb from Ben Franklin, blurbs the book you have there. And the book you have there, the dissertations, is based on lectures that he gave in the mid-1780s during his book tour when he was trying to sell copies of The Speller. So blurbs. He tries to get a blurb from Washington, but Washington declines. He's shameless. And for the dictionary, for the 1828 dictionary, I found a letter where he's asking John Marshall, the sitting Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, for a blurb. But Marshall also doesn't give him one. The publishing business, in 1788, he's here in New York for a year, right after Philadelphia, the Constitutional Convention, and he starts something called the American Magazine, which was one of our early literary magazines, maybe the Atlantic Monthly of its day. And it was, and one of the wonderful things about the Athenaeum, I mean, George Washington may have checked out books from this library, but George Washington's books are in the Boston Athenaeum. They have about a third of his library. So I got to look at his personal copies of Webster's books. So I got to look at George Washington's copy of this American magazine. And also, remember I told you that he goes to Mount Vernon and hands George Washington a copy of Sketches of American Policy. I also got to touch that. In case you're interested, Washington was not an underliner. So there's not a lot of action there. There's just a G, Washington. Now, Webster is also a savvy businessman. So he's an ardent Federalist, and he's an ally of Washington, but he's always looking at markets, and I'll come back to that. But when the in June 25th, 1788, New Hampshire becomes the ninth state to ratify the Constitution. So we now have the Constitution. Webster is excited because he worked for it. He wrote the pamphlet, and he was there at the convention. But he's also immediately thinking about the business angle. Remember, he went to all the states and got state copyright law passed. Well, under the Constitution, there's going to be national copyright law. So that very day, he writes to one of his publishers, "This," meaning the Constitution, "will allow me to enter into new contracts with regard to the speller." And he signs basically the first blockbuster deal in American publishing soon thereafter. All right, now we come to the tricky question of Webster's character. I talked about him being crotchety, and that's one of the reasons he fell out of favor. Joseph Ellis, the eminent biographer, says he's not the stuff of American mythology. He could be very nasty. He was a loner. One of his best friends was a fellow named Joel Barlow, who he went to Yale with, who became an epic poet in the late 18th century. He was friendly with Barlow for about 30 years, and one day he just wrote Barlow, say, I want nothing more to do with you, because Webster became religious and Barlow wasn't. He said, "You're an atheist. I want nothing more to do with you." 2 years later, he writes him a letter and asks him for a favor, pretending as if nothing ever happened. So that's the kind of guy. So Jill Lepore, looking at that kind of behavior, goes a bit further and says, well, he's no Joseph Stalin. But just the fact that you have to say that, she says basically he wasn't an evil man, he was an unlikable man. And I think what makes biography exciting is that people are complex, and I think biographers tend to either idealize or demonize figures. And I think what I'm trying to do in this book is say that, okay, he was crotchety, but he also had these great achievements, and maybe even there's a relationship between the personality disorder and the achievement. And I argue that he had what psychiatrists call obsessive compulsive personality disorder. He loved order, rules, and lists. Now, that's not the same as OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. People with OCD have trouble leaving the house. They're afraid that the house is going to burn down, and they're really anxious, and they'll check the stove 1,000 times, and they're never sure. They're not going to write a dictionary. But obsessive-compulsive personality disorder, those people have tremendous amounts of energy. And I did a piece for Psychology Today, and people with OCD often seek treatment because they have difficulty functioning. They'll try medication or therapy. But as I argue in that piece, people with OCPD, with the personality disorder, they tend to drive other family members into treatment, like their wives or their children. And Webster had a son who had lifelong depression, and I had a sense it wasn't being easy being his only son. He and Rebecca Greenleaf, I had something about her up there. He meets his wife at the Constitutional Convention, and I call that courtship at the Constitutional Convention. And Rebecca Greenleaf is very wealthy. She comes from a Boston family of 15 children. So Webster, in part, followed the person I wrote about in my last book, Peter Mark Roget of the Thesaurus, both made one, had a lot in common. One of the things they had in common is they both married rich, and that helped them with their literary careers. And I want to say about Webster is that he's a compiling and organizing machine. So it's not only words, but remember on that book tour, during his off days on the book tour, he would do a personal house count of the number of houses in every major American city. And I have that list that I fished out at the New York Public Library. So New York had about 3,300 houses. New York City then was just the Wall Street area, so you could walk around in a few hours. And that data set was later folded into the first census. But he just loves organizing and compiling. And one of the things I've said in some interviews is that for most of us, the task of writing a dictionary from scratch or a thesaurus from scratch would drive us crazy. But for my guys, it may well prevent them from going crazy. It organizes them and grounds them. He also was a public health expert. Here in New York in the 1790s, there was the yellow fever that was killing people left and right. And Webster was the editor of New York City's first daily newspaper. He immediately sent out a survey in the newspaper, and that's basically the foundation of public health research. So in the Arnold House, his first book is a brief history of epidemic and pestilential diseases. Now, brief for Webster is 700 pages, but it's this major public health treatise that William Osler has said was the most significant work by a non-medical person, you know, on a medical topic in the 19th century. He also, and this is something he shared with Thomas Jefferson, he loves to crunch temperature data. The thermometer was a new toy, kind of like your iPhone today in the 18th century, so a lot of obsessives would crunch the numbers, and Webster and Jefferson both crunched temperature data, and they actually have, I wrote a piece for the Smithsonian about how Webster, it wasn't Al Gore and George Bush, but it was Webster and Jefferson who had America's first great global warming debate. And then he also writes on the side a four-volume encyclopedia in the Arnold House. So he's compiling and organizing. And I think that this focus really, my obsessives tend to live very long. He lived till 85. Peter Marc Roget lived until 90. But again, their family members, some of them didn't thrive quite as well. All right, Webster and the Constitution. So I told you that he writes this pamphlet that he gives to Washington. Now, Webster lived in Connecticut, and what he wants to do is bring the reasonableness of Connecticut to the nation. And in this pamphlet that he passes on to Washington, he's going to make the case that we need to replace the Articles of Confederation with a more centralized government, and that we're going to need a new founding document. And he looks at Connecticut as his model, and he says, and he was friendly with Connecticut's governor, and he says, in Connecticut, thus the whole power of the state is brought to a single point, united in a single person. And that is basically a draft of the idea of the president. Because under the Articles of Confederation, there was no locus of power. It was all diffuse. There's one other point. So Washington gets the pamphlet, and I described this in the opening scene, and Washington always knew what to do. Remember, he's not an underliner, and Washington wasn't a policy guy. So I start the book with a dinner conversation between Webster and Washington. Webster makes these points that we need something like a constitution. And Washington is very nervous at this dinner because Washington wasn't a college guy, wasn't an underliner, but he was surrounded by all these brilliant people like James Madison from Princeton, John Adams from Harvard, Webster, a Yale guy. So at the end of the dinner in 1785 in May, he says, "Thank you very much, Mr. Webster. I'm going to pass on your pamphlet to James Madison as soon as possible, and he'll read it." So Washington was an expert delegator, and Madison looked at Webster's pamphlet and had it, at his side as he was thinking about the Constitution. And this is the official title of that 1787 pamphlet that Webster writes in the fall that I talked about earlier. Now, remember, in 1787, he's a future lexicographer. He wants to be a word guy, but he can't afford it. But he makes a brilliant argument in favor of the Constitution in this pamphlet. He makes a lexicographical argument. And he basically says the Constitution, the states should try to ratify the Constitution because the definitions are good. And if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's why that's been such a flexible and resilient document, and everyone is in love with it. And here's what he says, an example. The bounds of jurisdiction between the federal and state governments are marked with precision. And he's a guy who knew that kind of thing. Precision was his livelihood. All right, now a little bit about the dictionary. So he writes the Compendious Dictionary. That comes out in 1806. And for all my books, what I really love to do is archival research. And Webster's Dictionary, the 1828, the original manuscript, is not in one place. You can't just go to Yale or to the Morgan, but all of these places have pieces of it. The family sold off pages in the late 19th century to make money so they can get, I don't know, $10 a page, or and they kind of partialized it. So I went around to all the usual places, like the Morgan here in New York, New York Public, and Yale, Beinecke, and Sterling. But at a small museum in New Haven, I actually saw the first page, and I'll show that to you at the end of the talk. And it's as if he went to Staples and gets a little pamphlet and dates it and says, November 3rd, 1807. And surprise, surprise, a dictionary starts with A. And I'll show you that first page. And that page is the end paper of my book. So the first draft of, you know, the handwritten page for that book that you have there is in a small museum in New Haven, and the last biographers, and it's not like Lincoln, they're not 10,000 because of the crotchety, and also he wasn't a Civil War president, but considering his importance, there haven't been that many biographers, but I was the first person to find that in the New Haven Museum. And then he does A and B. And I talked about the religious conversion. He becomes a born-again Christian in 1808. And then he's got an idea. Remember I said he's very arrogant and he thinks he knows everything. In most cases, that serves him well. But here he's very arrogant and he makes a big mistake. Based on his religious beliefs, he is convinced that all languages go back to the language of his biblical namesake, Noah, on the ark. And he decides to spend 10 years writing an etymology. It's 1,000 pages, and today it's gathering dust at the New York Public Library. I spent a couple of days looking at it. There's a scholar who's written an article about it that I cite, but it's basically complete gibberish. So in most cases, his madness is helping him. His obsessionality is helping him write the dictionary. But here's one case, and I call this chapter A Lost Decade. And the Germans were actually coming up with solid etymology, but he ignores them. He's very arrogant. In fact, on that 1828 dictionary, he has one assistant, a guy named James Gates Percival, who was another kind of crazy dictionary maker, and that's a whole other story. He was a Yale eccentric. But Percival knows his etymology, and he's so horrified by what Webster is doing that he writes to a friend in Latin. He can't control himself. Multa absurda removi. Many absurd things I have removed. So Webster writes a 1,000-page etymology, and that's never published, but he tries to stick in some of his funny etymological ideas in the definitions. Percival tries to take them out, and Percival gets fired. So that's the loner for you. He fires his one helper. Now, James Murray, the editor of the Oxford English Dictionary, has tremendous respect for Webster. He calls Webster a great definer, but he's also sober and, when it comes to etymology, reality-based. And he says, critiquing Webster's etymology, he says, etymology is word history, and word history is a record of facts. Webster isn't interested in facts. In those 1,000 pages, he has one speculative hypothesis, which he backs with another one, and he's always right, and there's no empirical testing. And I love reading his letters, so in 1817, I'll read his letters, and he'll say, well, now I'm up to back to C. So that's how I get these comments. And in 1821, he's up to H. Now, a little bit about his method. The New York Public Library has the 1799 copy Webster's personal copy of Johnson's dictionary. And that has annotations. So Johnson's dictionary comes out in 1755. Johnson dies in about 1784, but it's constantly being expanded. And what was thrilling was to see what Johnson's 1799 is about 58,000 words. Webster's dictionary is going to be about 70,000 words. And what he's going to add is he's going to add a lot of terms from science and technology. But there are these little black marks on Johnson's dictionary. And Webster absolutely hated Shakespeare. Remember, Johnson and Webster have different sensibilities. Johnson has the soul of a poet, and he's always quoting Shakespeare for his definition. Webster wants to cite of a lot of American authors because it's an American dictionary, but he absolutely hates Shakespeare. And this goes back to his Yale days, because in the 1780s, drama was considered two steps away from sex. Yale students would be penalized for attending a play, or penalized twice as much for performing in a play. And what Webster does is he has these little black marks. I mean, I'm not going to cite Shakespeare here. But what he does in that 1828 dictionary is he blames Johnson for the blames Shakespeare for the dirty words in the English language. So if you look up in that book under whore son, son of a whore, he's just going to write shack, S-H-A-K. He's not going to quote Shakespeare, but it's just like, okay, that's Shakespeare, dirty word that you can blame Shakespeare. So yeah, that's part of his religious conversion. And that 1828 dictionary is also going to have his religious ideas. He's going to define marriage as a covenant between man, woman, and God. So, and I'll talk a little bit about how the dictionary has evolved. All right, so his method, he's leaning on Johnson, and he's also leaning on Robert Ainsworth, who wrote a Latin-English dictionary, and in the Morgan Library has Webster's annotated pages of Ainsworth's dictionary, and I show one of those pages in the biography. And he also has a lot of scientific encyclopedias, and he's going to be adding all these scientific terms, and that's also going to define America as a country, that we're a very, you know, we're the head of technology. That's really what America has been about, and the dictionary is going to really be a statement not only about the American language, about American culture and interests, and these decisions that Webster makes are going to have far-reaching consequences. All right. Now, Webster wants to write the dictionary because he can't stop, but no one else is interested in the dictionary. Americans love Johnson. I did a piece for the Globe that Americans have always loved Johnson, but Johnson actually hated Americans. He said, "I'm willing to love all mankind except an American." He thought we were a bunch of hypocrites. You know, they whelp about freedom over there in America, but then they have slavery. Well, it's a pretty good telling critique there. But we love Johnson, and everyone said, "Noah, you're messing with the established order. Don't do it." But he keeps doing it. And then he has an idea. He goes on a research trip to Europe in 1824. Remember, he's a canny businessman, and he's always looking for new markets. And one of the things about Webster and other obsessives is they're full of contradictions. So remember, in the 1780s, it's all about American nationalism. In the 1820s, the problem is how to market his dictionary. And he completely changes his tune. And he says, maybe I can come up with a new language, a new dictionary called the Universal Dictionary of the English Language, and market it on both sides of the Atlantic and have a wider market. So while he's in England, he wants to set up a conference between Oxford, Cambridge, and him to decide what this universal English would be. But Oxford and Cambridge can see through it, and they're not buying. And if they had, today we might all be spelling color the same way. They didn't. And he goes back, and eventually in 1827, he finds a New Haven publisher and publishes that book. Now, that book only sold about 2,500 copies. It wasn't a big seller, but what was a big seller was the abridged edition. And that's true today, at least until the iPhone. You know, the Collegiate Dictionary has sold 56 million copies, the Merriam-Webster, but the big fat one doesn't sell as many copies. But Webster can't stop. Remember, he loves the dictionary, and he doesn't, you know, he could have lived off the abridged dictionaries, but he wants to keep going. And at the age of 80, he mortgages his, he moves from the Arnold House to another house in New Haven. He mortgages his second house in New Haven to write the second edition of the dictionary. His family is horrified, and he's still going at it when he dies at 84 in 1843. And Harvard's Houghton Library has an 1844 edition of Webster's published in Amherst that's Emily Dickinson's personal copy. And just as Virginia Woolf couldn't have a room of her own, Emily Dickinson couldn't have a dictionary of her own. The only words in it are her father's. And that was her father's name. And that was the dictionary she used. She once describes it as her sole companion. And that says as much about the importance of Webster's as about her eccentricity. She was a loner. But she uses that dictionary to write her poetry. And I blogged about this because the flyleaf of the dictionary is all worn down. There was a green marble foredge, and all the green is gone because she kind of lived in that dictionary as she wrote her poetry. But so the 1841 is the last major revision, and then there's this minor revision that comes out in 1844. And today we talk about new words like the blogosphere or whatever the word, or LOL or something. But Webster in 1844, here are the new words that he was sticking in. So he died, but on his deathbed he had these new words which were then folded into the 1844 dictionary. And some of those new words were aerodynamics, agronomy, and puritanically. Now a little bit about the dictionary since Webster. Merriam-Webster comes in around 1847. They buy it from the family. And remember, there's all that bogus etymology. And I did a piece for The Nation about the 1864 edition of Webster's. So that's going to be the first modern, great modern English dictionary. It's not going to have any of the religious stuff. It's not going to have the bogus etymology. And the way it came about is the publisher, and I read this at correspondence at Yale, that the publisher realized, because the Brothers Grimm had come up with the German dictionary, and realized that the etymology was all wrong, and if he didn't fix it, so he doesn't have the 1,000 pages, but there's still those ideas that he's inserting constantly. So they hired a German to do the etymology, and they published this 1864 edition of Webster's. Now that 1864 edition, I argue in this Nation piece, is really the template for the OED. The OED is based on Webster's 1864. James Murray, when he proposes the OED, says it's going to be about 7 times as big, and it's actually about 10 times as big. But what I'm arguing is that that's really a great dictionary, and the OED is much bigger. The OED finally comes out in 1928, the last volume, but it's not all that much better. The first modern dictionary that you could use with solid etymology, with a lot of illustrative quotations, is really that Webster's 1864. And after my Nation story came out, a fellow who's writing a new history of the OED from Oxford Press wrote me an email, and I started corresponding to him and I asked him, whatever happened to James Murray's copy? Because James Murray's copy of the 1864 was kind of like Webster's copy of the 1799 of Johnson. And he said that Murray used it so much that it was pulverized. And I want to make the point that Webster was crotchety, and maybe as a result that American lexicographers really have gotten short shrift. And we really need to see that the world capital of English lexicography from 1798 to 1864 was New Haven. And I make a joke, for those of you who know about literary criticism, that you know, a century before we had Yale's hermeneutic mafia, we had their lexicographical mafia in the 1860s, that 1864 was half of the Yale faculty got together and wrote that dictionary. And one of the contributors was W.C. Minor. Those of you who are hardcore word nerds will remember that name. W.C. Minor is The Madman in Simon Winchester's bestseller, The Professor and the Madman. And that's about the correspondence between James Murray, who I've talked about, the editor of the OED, and his right-hand man, who wrote thousands of illustrative quotations from his cell in an insane asylum. He was a Yale student who went mad and was locked up in a British insane asylum. Well, Winchester, as a Brit who thinks that Americans don't know much about lexicography, never looked at the 1864 because Miner's name is in it. And I went back into the files and I found Miner's contract that the future star of the OED actually worked on Webster's 1864. But there's even more than that, is that the 1864 was revered. Every publication wrote glowing reviews. No one had ever seen anything like it. But the one weak link was W.C. Minor. And people came after him and saying his definitions were lousy. And they were. He wasn't a good definer. For the OED, what he does is he compiles illustrative quotations. He doesn't actually do definitions. So the fellow from England, when I relayed this information to him, he said, well, that James Murray, he always knew what to do. He gave Miner the right assignment. He didn't trust him with definitions. But the point that I want to make is that the future star of the OED couldn't cut it as an American lexicographer. And I think that we need to be proud of Noah Webster, crotchety or not, and our American lexicographers. All right, thanks very much. I want to show the slides. Yeah. So I have a few slides. Okay. Let's see. So that's A. So that's what I found at the New Haven Museum. And he worked on large sheets and went back over them. I think Murray had note cards, but he worked on these large sheets from something like a Staples, you know, notebook. Just to give you a sense of the archival research, this is a copy from, this is at Yale Sterling Library. This is a copy of a memoir that Webster wrote, and it's too small to read, but he wrote about a 30-page memoir. There's a lot of primary source material that I use, diaries and memoir, and here he's talking about a traumatic event of his life, and he says the subject of his memoir was cast upon the world at the age of 20. Noah Webster graduates from Yale in 1778. He wants to become a writer. His father's a poor farmer. His father gives him an $8 bill. There was hyperinflation. It was basically worthless. And he says, son, you're on your own now. And Webster's reaction was, the subject of this memoir was cast upon the world. And he felt abandoned and despair. But as with my other obsessives, I think out of that adversity comes this tremendous drive. So I think out of this pain, 5 years later, we have the speller, and then we have the dictionary, and that's kind of my sense of how Webster worked. Okay, this is going to be, yikes, it's going to be hard. Can you turn this around? Just possible. No, this is a copy of the compendious dictionary. Yeah, view, yep. If you just turn it, rotate, yep, that's it, great. So just do it twice, whichever way should do it. Oh, there it is. So I don't know if you can enlarge it. Can you go to that, yeah, where it says 49.6? Yeah. See how far, So this is what the compendious dictionary looks like. So this is what's replacing Johnson Jr., these one-word definitions. So that was, this is the first time the word Webster's Dictionary. And Webster was a great publicist. So in 1806, he announces to the world, Webster's Dictionary is ready, and that's what it was. Okay, and let's see. All right. So now the next one. You may have to rotate again. All right. Yeah, and this is a copy of the 1828. Sorry, it's one more rotation. All right, I want to see marriage on the left, and if you get down a little bit, and this is what he defines marriage as. A marriage was instituted by God Himself for the purpose of preventing the promiscuous intercourse of the races. Now, there's an age-old debate in lexicography about whether lexicographers should describe words or describe the language or prescribe the language. Webster's position was descriptive, and the Merriam-Webster editor in 1961 followed that point of view and stuck the word ain't in the dictionary, normalizing it. Everyone was horrified. The New Yorker had a cartoon a couple of weeks later, Merriam-Webster's secretary saying the editor ain't in, as if that's the way they talked over in Springfield. So Webster is going to be a describer of language, and his position is now widespread. So if Sarah Palin says something, repudiate, she says that word 10 times, a lexicographer is going to grimace. But if that word is said 1,000 times, they're going to have to start thinking about sticking it in if it's all over the place. But the reason I bring that up now is that he's descriptive in his understanding of language. But prescriptive, he wants to tell his readers how to live. And these books are part autobiography. He wants to tell them, just like Joel Barlow, he wants to tell them about the good Christian life. And the 1864 is going to take that out, and that's the first modern English dictionary that you could go to that's kind of an objective source. All right, the next one. So this is his house count list. So can we just go? Yep. So these are all the cities that he visits, and you see Philadelphia, he rounds off. He doesn't even like messy numbers like 4582. He's going to round it off to 4,600. Philadelphia, New York is 3,235, and this was the data set that was folded in to the 1790 census. And he has a couple of friends who are in other cities, and they're collecting and gathering and crunching this data. And I've tried to go to a bunch of those cities on my tour. All right. And this is the marked up copy of the Ainsworth Latin dictionary, Latin English dictionary from the Morgan. And I illustrate, I use the word adultery. It's very colorful in the book to show what he gets from this dictionary and what he gets from Johnson and how he, because here he's talking about. And these are his annotations on the Latin word adulter. Okay, so now I'm ready for questions. Do you have any?
Yep. How much of a lexicographer was he? Where did he get his material from? Did he depend on other sources, or did he originate some of the definitions himself?
So there's been a study of comparing his dictionary to Johnson's. So about the lexicographers, you know, all borrow from each other. You know, Murray's borrowing from Webster, Webster took about 1/3 of his definitions from Johnson, and Johnson's borrowing from a guy named Bailey. But so 2/3 are going to be new. And you know, today with the internet, you know, lexicographers are combing the web constantly. But in his day, it would just be printed material. And he'd be reading very, very widely, as I was saying, reading in the sciences. But it was really, for 2/3 of the words, he's going to be the person coming up with that definition himself. Yep?
So I think you use this word, I guess, advisedly, obsessive.
Right.
What other ways was that shown in his life? And also, if I can just pile on here, you didn't mention much about his family, married, kids.
Right. So with obsessives, I find that their primary relationship is to their work. So he had a lot of problems in relationships. He was very domineering. His wife kept a neat house and was very organized and was very religious. but she played ball and she made his favorite pie, custard pie. So, you know, I had a sense that there was a cost to her of kind of doing things Webster's way. So I just sensed he was very controlling, and the family members didn't really complain about him, but every once in a while, the adult children say he treats us like boys and girls, you know, when they're in their 30s. But there weren't major complaints. And again, he's a collecting, organizing, and I think it's almost as if he obsessing about the dictionary is a way maybe not to be feeling, because people who are more connected to the relationships are feeling relationships more. And I think he is kind of escaping the relational world to a certain degree. And his room had where he worked in the dictionary had sand in it, and it's kind of this sanctum sanctorum where he was kind of safe from the world. And I have a sense that that fueled him and for the dictionary itself. And he was a great definer of words, and he had this brilliant analytic mind that goes well with the obsessional temperament. Johnson's definitions are more flowery, but Webster, and I give examples in the book, is clearer, and the precision is really remarkable. And I think that's something. And I guess I'm arguing that the obsessionality was an asset to lexicography. That if he hadn't had it, it might have taken America longer to come up with its first dictionary. He very much wanted to. He's basically teaching kids how to sound out words.
Phonetics.
Yeah, and trying to give kids an American identity. In the back of the speller, he lists little tables of key events in American history. The British speller had names of British cities, and that's what kids in the 1780s were using, and he replaced them with names of American cities. But it's basically, first volume, the one that sold so well, was a way to teach kids how to read by breaking down sentences, and that's why the Jefferson Davis sentence was a sample sentence that kids, and they'd have a couple of lessons, and then they would have a sentence like that to practice. Yeah.
How does the speller compare to McGuffey's reader?
Well, McGuffey's reader. Remember, I told you there were three parts. There was a speller, a grammar, and a reader. McGuffey's replaced his reader. So his reader wasn't a big seller. And I haven't, I mean, there's some, Webster, I mean, the publications are enormous in the 700-page brief treatise, so I'm not an expert on that. You know, but there are people who have written about that topic, about how they differ and why McGuffey's caught on, but I'm not the expert there. Yep.
I'm interested in Webster and Minor.
Yep.
Did he know him from Yale? And was it before he went to the insane asylum?
Yes. So I did my research on Minor. So again, remember I called the Yale lexicographical mafia. Noah Porter, who's a Yale professor, is in charge. He's the editor. Minor is a Yale med student. And he gets this part-time job. And I have the contract in my book. He gets this part-time job to work on the natural history definitions. And it's funny because I've also written about the idea of the crazy lexicographer. Minor gets his job because the Yale professor James Dana has a nervous breakdown. They're all having nervous breakdowns. James Dana has a nervous breakdown, and that's Minor's entry into the dictionary business. And then after Yale Medical School, he becomes a doctor in the Civil War. And then he gets some kind of post-traumatic stress disorder, and he goes to England to kind of chill out. But while he's there, he murders someone, and then they lock him up. Yep.
How did this religious conversion happen?
It was very common. Yale had this very, New Haven had a very dashing pastor who I describe in the book. He's very handsome and eloquent, and it was called the Second Great Awakening, and it was very common even among intellectuals in New England. And Webster, not everyone, Barlow, for instance, didn't join in, but and for the rest of his life, he was a churchgoer. And to this day, Webster is revered by the homeschooling crowd. There is a facsimile edition of the 1828 dictionary that's published by a Christian publisher because they see Webster, you know, as a model, both of scholarship and also they like his prescriptive side. Yep.
He was a born again Christian.
Yes.
What was he born?
Congregational. And he's always changing, so he writes in his memoir in the 1770s at Yale, he's chasing women and drinking and going out with the fast crowd. And then once he's born again, he wants to write an expurgated anthology of English poetry to take out all the dirty words. And then in the 1830s, he publishes, Jill Lepore blogged about this recently, he does an expurgated translation of the Bible. The King James Bible. Someone back there, yep. Yeah, these dictionaries, they weren't, I write it in the book, I've just been away from it for a while, but they were reasonably priced, and Webster, again, he's always marketing, so he writes in a newspaper article, you know, buy one for every member of the family kind of thing, but he needs to go on the research trip to Europe because he wants to look at at French and Italian dictionaries from the 18th century, so you know, some of those older dictionaries are going to be very expensive, and America's libraries aren't going to have them. But Webster's dictionaries themselves were. Was that the question?
Do you know exactly what they
cost? Yeah, it's in the book. I can't remember off the top of my head. Yeah. Yep. Did you have one? Yep.
So you've done a book on Roget, and now you've done a book on Webster.
Right.
Is there someone else you're thinking of?
Yes. Yes, I started a new book, and I'm taking my obsession out of the word nerds and applying it to American culture at large. And I'm doing profiles of several American icons who had an obsessive temperament. If you think about someone like Mark Zuckerberg, if some of you have seen the Facebook movie, remember I showed you that Webster letter where he gets rejected, and a couple years later comes out with The Speller. Well, if you think about Mark Zuckerberg, if you've seen that movie, the first scene, he's rejected, and then he spends 20 hours on computer code and comes up with Facebook, pulls an all-nighter. And I think that's the same kind of temperament. So I'm going to try to relate the current techie to this whole history of American obsession, and starting maybe with Jefferson. Yeah. Because he's a number cruncher too, you know, with the data and.